Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
August 1619. 400 years ago this month, the first group of enslaved Africans was forcibly brought by British colonists to what is now the United States. In history books, the moment is often overlooked, despite being as central to our country's history as the Declaration of Independence or the drafting of the Constitution. And you've been telling us how slavery was taught when you were in school.
Hi, this is Nikki from San Francisco. I was taught that slaves were dregs in the fields, happy they had a master because they were unevolved, childish, needed guidance from also the Civil War was about states' rights, not about whether people should be able to own, sell, or abuse other human beings because of the color of their skin. So as a black girl growing up in Tucson, it made me very angry and sad because I knew it was a lie.
Hi, this is Kathy calling from Dallas, Texas. In school, I was taught that the Civil War was originally about states' rights. It was more of a political action, the South wanting to secede from the North for political reasons.
This is Katie in Seattle. As the great-great-great-granddaughter of an abolitionist and the great-great-granddaughter of a Union soldier, I was always taught that slavery was perhaps our greatest sin ever committed in America. It was and always has been the real reason for the Civil War, no matter what anybody tries to argue. I'll be forever proud that my ancestors sheltered runaway slaves and fought for the freedom of every human.
Hi, this is Barry Wynn from Brighton, Michigan. In school, I was taught that slavery was a sad chapter of our country's history that was thankfully over. In my community, I learned that it was an unresolved chapter that still loomed large in our lives. I wanted to believe the former, but I had to face the truth of the latter.
The penetrating history of slavery in the United States is frequently ignored in our education system, and the failure to properly address its legacy continues to shape our world today. This week, the New York Times is aiming to correct the narrative with an expansive series of essays called The 1619 Project. I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on a special Takeaway podcast, we're looking at this anniversary through the lens of the three societal gaps at the core of our show's mission: the truth gap, the wealth gap, and the empathy gap. And we start with truth. What would a true reckoning with our history actually look like? And why does society seem to turn away from that idea? Dr. Ibram X. Kendi is the author of the new book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, and the director of the Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center at American University. Ibram, thanks for coming back on The Takeaway.
It's great to be on the show.
And Stephanie E. Jones-Rogers is an associate professor of history at the University of California, Berkeley. Stephanie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Tanzina.
So we're talking today to mark 400 years, which is an infamous anniversary, since slaves were first brought to what is now the United States. And it's kind of hard to imagine other events that are so historically significant being ignored, essentially, like this one has been. I mean, Ibram, what does that say about the country's relationship with its slaveholding past?
I think it says that America's trying to deny that relationship, to depress, to ignore, to shove into the closet, to imagine that this nation wasn't built, its wealth wasn't built on slavery. And I think that obviously, you know, any nation or any person who is denying and not seeking to acknowledge and recognize and talk about their own history, there's obviously a serious problem there.
Stephanie, your thoughts on that question, on the lack of historical acknowledgement of this moment right now?
So I think our nation's amnesia about slavery has a lot to do with how the story of America has and really has not been told. We often learn about slavery as an institution that was tangential to the founding of the nation, more like an inconvenient regime that had nothing to do with the founders' vision of the nation and its fledgling democracy. But when we teach people that slavery was unimportant to the nation, its founding principles, its laws, its economy, and its social order, why would you want to know more about it? You know, and I think this is key to this lack of understanding, lack of knowledge. And as you said, you know, this infamous anniversary, many people not knowing about it and not wanting to memorialize it and commemorate it. So I think that has a lot to do with it as well.
The two words that came to mind here were recognition of this date, but also a reckoning with slavery. And I'm wondering, I'd like to hear from both of you, what kind of recognition and by extension, what kind of reckoning should we be having as a nation on this day? Ibram.
I think that first and foremost, we should sort of recognize just how long slavery lasted in this country and the lingering sort of impact on this country. So to give an example, you know, obviously people who owned slaves were able to acquire in many cases a tremendous amount of wealth that has been passed on, wealth that still allows for a seismic racial wealth gap, which is growing in this country. And so there's so many different ways in which slavery and its history lives. And so to deny those connections is to deny how it is living and how we can solve those present problems that are the product of the past.
Stephanie, your thoughts. How do we recognize and also reckon with this moment?
Well, I think fundamentally we have to teach the narrative of American history, the American story, in a very different way, one in which African Americans are not, as Nicole Hannah-Jones of the New York Times said, inconvenient to the country's narrative. We need to teach it in a way wherein African Americans and their experiences in the United States, those experiences are fundamental to our national story, that they are key, as Professor Kendi said, key to understanding our economic development, our national development, our democratic development. So I think putting African American experience at the center of the story of America is a way in which we can reckon with this amnesia, this slaveholding past, and begin to recognize how fundamental and important African descended people are to this nation's history and narrative.
You know, Stephanie, when I think about the ways that we were educated, I was educated in a public school in an underfunded community in the Lower East Side of New York with fellow black and brown kids growing up. A lot of my education, I think, was limited. And I'm wondering if you can speak to some of the shortcomings around how we educate our children about not just American history, but American slavery.
Sure. I share that same kind of, I don't want to say ignorance, but this kind of lack of understanding and knowledge about the institution of slavery and how fundamental it was to the country. I didn't really begin to learn about slavery in all its particularities until college, which is, you know, it's egregious. And I think that continues to be the case for many students, many young students in the country today. You can see battles in places like Texas on how to talk about and how to frame slavery for younger audiences. But here at Berkeley, we have an initiative, and there are initiatives throughout the country that are trying to correct this, offer corrective, wherein we work directly with K through 12 teachers on different curricular endeavors. And slavery is a part of that, talking about the racial terror that exists and develops after slavery to kind of keep a subjugated class in place, a subjugated race in place. That's a fundamental part of the curricular activities that we engage in. So I think fostering a relationship between those who know this knowledge and those who impart this knowledge on young people is important. But I also think, again, that these wars, these kind of textbook wars, are also fundamental a fundamental problem. They lead to the kind of ignorance around this issue or lack of understanding of slavery. So I think that's also critical. So we need to get it into the textbooks and help to understand that framing it properly in textbooks and allowing for teachers to have access to this knowledge and understanding this knowledge is important to imparting it to younger generations.
Black slaves were not just denied their basic humanity, but even after slavery was abolished in the United States, Black Americans were denied their basic constitutional rights, and some would even argue that they still are in some ways. Ibram, how has that denial of humanity and denial of basic civil and human rights affected how Black people view their relationship within and with the United States?
Yeah, so for instance, some time ago when four U.S. citizens who were also congresswomen of color were told publicly by the President of the United States and his supporters to go back to where they came from, it sort of caused me to remember that really from our arrival here 400 years and certainly even from the time of the end of the Civil War, that Black Americans have been arguing that question. Am I an American? And some Black Americans have said, indeed, I am an American. And because I'm American, I deserve my rights. I deserve to be treated like an American. I deserve to be recognized as human. While others have said, no, actually, we are not an American, because if we were Americans, we would actually have those rights. We would actually be free. And so someone like Malcolm X, who once said in 1964, I'm neither a Republican nor a Democrat nor an American, but got sense enough to know it. And Langston Hughes, who wrote in a poem, I too am American. So actually, Black people have been debating this for quite some time.
Stephanie, did the country come any closer to reckoning with this racist past with the election of President Obama, who himself was often not allowed to speak about racism?
I would say no. I see some really clear kind of connections between the Obama era. So when we elected President Barack Obama and his 8 years in office, and what happened immediately after slavery was abolished. What you have is this moment after slavery of great promise, of great hope. And so what you see is the emergence of large numbers of Black male voters, politically active African-Americans, individuals who are entering office at the state level, at the local level, on the communal level. And what you see in response to that is an immediate, violent, and vitriolic backlash, white backlash. Similarly, you see that right after President Obama is elected. The Southern Poverty Law Center, for example, says that hate groups, white supremacist, white terrorist groups, increased 800% shortly after President Barack Obama was elected and continue to increase since he was in office. And you see increasingly this kind of racial violence and terror throughout the country after President Donald Trump was elected. So I would say that, yes, while his election was a moment of promise and it symbolized our hope for a future that wasn't kind of tainted by our past, our racist past, what you see in the aftermath is an immediate white backlash. And many pundits, et cetera, have said that it's largely why we are seeing a Trump era. We have a Trump era in the first place.
You mentioned pundits. And Ibram, I'm curious about your thoughts on what role the media has played in some of these inadequacies of how we reckon or even recognize slavery and its long-term implications.
Well, obviously, when we talk about, as Professor Jones Rogers and I talks about people not being able to reckon with this past, we're talking about everyday people. And everyday people include members of the media, who, of course, went to the same schools we talked about earlier, were not taught about slavery, were taught in some cases that the Civil War was about states' rights, or were essentially taught myths about our past. And so as a result, as they go about doing their job, even if they're seeking to be well-meaning, that, of course, comes back. That affects them. I mean, even something as simple as classifying, writing the word in a story, writing the word racist in a story is very, very difficult for many journalists, even though, like all of the other words in their stories, it's found in the dictionary. It has a very clear definition, and we should use it when it applies, just like every other word. But somehow, many members of the media have imagined that it's a political act when you objectively state that a person is saying something or doing something racist, when in fact it is not. It is using the definition and using words to describe reality, which should be the jobs of journalists.
Stephanie, what approaches can we or should we take about having an honest conversation about American slavery? And I want to add to that, how much of this is about educating white Americans about what happened, and also educating each other about the reality of what happened?
So I think one of the fundamental things that we need to do, as I referenced earlier, is place African Americans' experiences in this nation at the center of the story of our nation and of American democracy. Because as I'll reference the 1619 Project again, many of those contributors argue that in order to really fully reckon with this past, you have to see African Americans not as the problem, but as part of the solution. That's one of the things that Ms. Jones said in her piece. And we have, as she also argues, for 400 years seen African Americans as a problem, as outside of our national narrative. But that, I think, one of the first things we need to do is to correct that view, correct that perspective, and to place them at the center of the story, and also to understand how significant their roles have been in the development of the democracy that we hold so dear, the ideals and principles of the Founding Fathers, and how they have forced us to reflect upon our hypocrisy in many respects. So part of that process must necessarily include discussions about slavery and understanding how very central slavery has been, not simply to the experiences of African Americans, but also to those of white Americans, Euro-descended Americans.
And Ibram, your thoughts on that. How do we, as a nation, get past not being able to talk about this and really have an honest conversation about what happened with American slavery?
I think first and foremost, we have to recognize that just because a story is a story of terror, as the story of slavery is, just because the story is the story of violence and rape, that doesn't mean within that story, that same story, we can't have stories of the building of culture. So what I'm saying is ultimately, just because the story is difficult to tell, the difficult to receive, just like in order to heal, we have to, of course, sometimes experience pain. We have to tell those difficult stories in order to look at our own current reality. Because in order to truly see and understand why there are so many disparities in our country today, why so many people demean and degrade Black people, we have to understand the story of slavery. And even to understand a question like, for instance, why did so many white women vote for Trump? You know, one of the books that allowed me to understand that was actually a book looking at the history of slavery. Professor Jones Rogers' new book, They Were Her Property, which talked about white women as slave owners and the ways in which white women actually benefited from this slaveholding enterprise as owners themselves, and the ways in which white women today are benefiting from white supremacy. So we have to be able to make those connections, because if we can understand the past, it will allow us to better understand the present.
Dr. Ibram X. Kendi is the author of the new book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, and the director of the Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center at American University. And Stephanie E. Jones Rogers is an associate professor of history at the University of California, Berkeley. Thank you both.
Thank you so much, Tanzina.
Thank you.
This is Frank in Richmond, Virginia. In elementary school, we were taught about slaves being brought over from Africa as if that was like a storehouse full of slave stock. We were also taught about the struggle to free slaves, the Civil War, and emancipation. The whole time, as long as I can remember, I always questioned the validity of removing people from their homes to lead a miserable life as a slave. This line of questioning was seldom responded to. I still feel strongly about how Black people are treated in today's world and sympathize with the hurdles they face just because of the pigment in their flesh.
You can really draw a clear line from the earliest days of slavery to the racial wealth gap and the economic picture of this country today. 400 years since slavery began in the United States, we're going to make those connections explicit with William Darity, who goes by Sandy. He's the director of the Samuel Du Bois Cook Center on Social Equity at Duke University.
Slavery contributed to the economic growth of the United States as a collectivity, particularly after the formation of the Republic in 1776. The classic phrase that cotton is king is a phrase that really did have substance because it was the preeminent sector in the country. And associated with that was the sustained exploitation of enslaved labor to produce the cotton. So we refer accurately to slave-grown cotton. And so if we look at the cotton sector's impact, say, on New York City, the growth and development of New York City was very closely connected to the successes that New York-based entrepreneurs had that was linked to the cotton sector. The state of Connecticut's textile sector was connected, obviously, to cotton as well. So cotton had a nationwide impact on economic growth.
Sandy, do we have any idea of the scope of, I guess, of the scope of how much money was lost or was, should I say, stolen from African slaves for this type of labor?
My colleague Thomas Kramer at the University of Connecticut says that we should count every 24-hour segment as time that was stolen from the individuals who were enslaved. And I think using that as a gauge, he comes up with an estimate of the total amount of labor seized or appropriated from enslaved black folks in the vicinity of $12 to $14 trillion.
Let's talk a little bit about post-Reconstruction. What were some of the policies once slavery was abolished post-Reconstruction that continued to have an economic impact on black wealth versus white wealth?
I think the most decisive policy was actually a policy that was not implemented. The formerly enslaved promise, land grants of 40 acres, and actually General Sherman began the process of allocating those land grants to folks who had been newly emancipated. And that policy was reversed after President Lincoln was assassinated by his successor, Andrew Johnson. And so with the reversal of that policy, there was a sustained and systematic denial of access to an initial endowment in land on the part of the formerly enslaved. And I think that that's the foundation for the kinds of inequalities we observe today in terms of black-white wealth differences.
Well, let's talk about that. You and I have talked about this for years now. It's something known as the racial wealth gap. Let's draw that line from slavery, post-Reconstruction, Jim Crow, to this racial wealth gap we're experiencing. The last numbers that I understand are that white Americans, again, on average, have about 10 to 13 times the wealth that black Americans do in this country.
Yeah, but another way to think about it is that black Americans own about 2.6% of the nation's wealth, but constitute closer to 13% of the nation's population. So the black share in the nation's wealth falls far below the black share of the nation's population. And it would suggest that if you were going to eliminate that disparity, it would require an expenditure in the vicinity of $10 to $12 trillion. So that's the task that I would personally set for a reparations program if one was inaugurated in the United States. But the magnitude of the racial wealth gap or gulf is immense, and it would require a correspondingly immense program of restitution.
Sandy, you mentioned reparations, and we've talked a lot about this here on The Takeaway. Some folks have criticized reparations as being purely economic or just a check. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't view a check as something that is something that's trivial or unimportant. Given the magnitude of the huge differences in wealth that we have been talking about, an appropriately sized check, if you will, would exactly be what we need as a mechanism for getting rid of that enormous wealth gap. I don't think that a reparations program for black descendants of persons who were enslaved in the United States necessarily has to be limited two direct payments to eligible recipients, although that's been the characteristic of many, many reparations programs internationally, whether we're thinking about reparations program that Germany inaugurated to compensate or to provide restitution to the victims of the Holocaust, whether we're talking about the United States' own program of reparations for Japanese Americans who were unjustly incarcerated in the United States, or whether we're talking about the reparations that were provided to families who lost loved ones in the 9/11 tragedy. All those cases, there are significant amounts of monetary payments that were made to the eligible recipients. And so I'm always a little bit startled when people say that's not appropriate for Black Americans. And I wonder why they feel that way. But a reparations program does not have to be restricted to that. There are other ways in which the funds could be dispersed besides direct payments to the eligible recipients. But I think for both substantive and symbolic reasons, an important component of any reparations program for Black American descendants of persons who were enslaved here must include payments to eligible recipients.
Do you see this as being a realistic, and when I say realistic, I don't mean whether it's morally appropriate or economically necessary, but I say whether or not there's political will to do something like a full-scale reparations program in the United States, given that we've outlined all of the reasons why Black Americans in particular have been unfairly maligned by these economic policies. Do you actually see a future, Sandy, in which this is something that will have the political will behind it to actually happen?
So in my more pessimistic moments, I would probably give you a negative answer on that, in large part, because we have a Mitch McConnell-led Senate. And so I would think that the Senate would have to have a different composition for us to have a realistic opportunity for a reparations program to actually be enacted. However, there are some optimistic signs. So the first optimistic sign is the fact that we're actually having a national conversation about reparations now, a national conversation that actually has engaged folks who are serious candidates for the presidency. I think only one or two of them have actually endorsed a program of reparations. But several of them have indicated that they would support the formation of a commission. So to the extent that that's something that several of the candidates are in favor of, that's an excellent potential starting point for the development of a reparations program. I know that in the case of the Japanese American reparations program, it was preceded by a study commission, which engaged in two tasks. The first task was to set the historical record straight, to demonstrate that American officials knew that Japanese Americans were not a security threat, but still proceeded to have them placed in camps around the country. And then the second task that commission conducted was to design or develop a program of restitution. So I think it's entirely appropriate that we follow the same kind of pattern with respect to the development of a Black reparations program in the United States. And I think we have not had a conversation about reparations for Black Americans in the United States on this scale or on this order since the Reconstruction era.
William Sandy Darity is the director of the Samuel Du Bois Cook Center on Social Equity at Duke University. Sandy, thanks again for being with us.
Thank you.
I slide my ring finger from Senegal to South Carolina and feel the ocean separate a million families. The soft hum of history spins on its tilted axis. A cavalcade of ghost ships wash their hands of all they carry.
Clint Smith is a writer and doctoral candidate at Harvard University, and he wrote several poems for the New York Times' 1619 Project. Clint, thanks for being with us on The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me.
I started thinking about this idea of empathy in Black Americans back in 2017. I wrote a piece for CNN about it, and I started that piece with W.E. Du Bois's writings, in which he says, there have been, for instance, few other cases in the history of civilized peoples where human suffering has been viewed with such peculiar indifference. Clint, where does that indifference stem from when we talk about the suffering of Black Americans?
Yeah, I think that quote is so profound and so accurate. I think, you know, part of the insidiousness of racism is that the lack of empathy for Black Americans stems from a myriad of different places. I think what is so wonderful about the 1619 issue is that it kind of talks about a little bit of that. And something that I've been thinking a lot about is the history of pseudoscience and the history of eugenics and the history that made it so that so many people throughout civilization, you know, across Western civilization, even in a post-Enlightenment and perhaps most insidiously in a post-Enlightenment era, believed that Black people did not feel physical pain in the same way. And that's outlined in a wonderful essay by Linda Villarosa. And then there's also the, you know, we can go back to Jefferson. He is, in essence, the paragon of American ideals. He represents the best of American aspirations, and he is the intellectual founding father of this country. And he is also someone who enslaved 600 people. He's also someone who enslaved his own children. He's also someone who wrote in Notes on the State of Virginia that Black people did not possess the same level of intellectual or emotional acumen as their white counterparts, that they did not have the emotional capacity with which to create art. I think those are part of the origin story of a lack of empathy that continued to blossom throughout history. If you don't understand the history of public policy and how it shaped these communities, what happens is then you can look at certain communities and fall into the trap, even for well-intentioned folks, fall into the trap of thinking that the people who live there somehow deserve the conditions that they have found themselves in, that it is somehow their fault, that it is somehow a result of a cultural or genetic or biological inferiority, rather than things that have been done to those communities generation after generation after generation.
I want to bring that to where we are today to a certain extent. I mean, on this program, we've discussed how President Trump's rhetoric around certain issues, whether it's Black Americans, Latino Americans, Latino migrants, has emboldened white supremacists. How much does that rhetoric play into what we're seeing today in a lack of empathy towards Black Americans specifically?
I think it plays a huge role. I mean, I think that we should be clear that it does not begin and does not end with the president. But I think we should also be clear that he fuels the flames and the sort of sentiments that have sort of existed in the underbelly of so many parts of this country and for millions of people in this country have now been brought to the fore. And in many ways, he's far more explicit than so many of his predecessors have ever been. And to be clear, you know, that does not mean that people who came before him were not instituting policies that were imbued with systemic racism and structural racism and reinforced a lot of the harmful public policies that impact Black communities. But we can't underestimate and overstate the extent to which President Trump's rhetoric has played a huge role in saturating the discourse in a way that other folks who have come before him more recently have not done so.
Clint, we asked some of our listeners what they were taught about slavery in school. And one person said, quote, "It's time to get over it." How do we acknowledge or even respond to that? Do we have to respond to that?
Yeah. So the way that I think about this is that there are two groups of folks. I think there are folks who you can provide them with all of the facts that you want that demonstrate the role that slavery has played in shaping the contemporary landscape of inequality in this country, and they won't care. It won't matter to them. But I do think that there is a group of people, and I think that this has become clear over the past several days in which people have been talking about how much they've learned from the 1619 Project from the New York Times. There are a group of people who simply don't know. You know, I always give this timeline. The first enslaved Africans came to this country in 1619. The Emancipation Proclamation happened in 1863. Civil War ended in 1865. Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act were 1964 and 1965. Federal Housing Act was 1968. So it's only been about 50 years in which Black people in this country have even had a semblance of legal and legislative freedom. For 350 years prior to that, it was fundamentally legal to discriminate against, dehumanize, delegitimize, and disenfranchise Black people. Not in the interpersonal, somebody being mean and using the N-word, but you are a state section, second-class citizen, if considered a citizen at all. So if you were to kick somebody for 350 years and then you stop kicking them, ostensibly, for a seventh of the amount of time that you spent kicking them, it would be both morally and intellectually disingenuous to then look at that group of people and be like, what's wrong with you? Why don't you have the same economic outcomes? Why is there so much violence and poverty in your community? But we have convinced ourselves that this history is somehow a long time ago when it wasn't actually that long ago at all. I was interviewing my grandmother not too long ago. There was a moment in which my daughter, who's 6 months old, was sitting on her lap, and she was telling about how she used to sit on her grandfather's lap. And her grandfather is the person who raised her, and her grandfather was someone who was born into slavery. It was this profound moment in which I realized that, you know, my daughter was sitting on the lap of someone who sat on the lap of someone who was born into bondage. And that is the lineage of my family. And that is, slavery is so, still so alive in my lineage. And I think that we forget, with all the black and white videos and all of the images in our textbooks, some of which are there and aren't there, I think we can convince ourselves that something happened a long time ago when it actually didn't happen that long ago at all.
You mentioned the black and white videos, and I think a lot of us, we sort of see that as part of our cultural narrative, our cultural mythology in this country. And I almost think we can sort of pack, a lot of people say, well, we'll pack that up, we'll put that back in the 1960s and we'll move on. But the media showed those videos. The media has also had a role in perpetrating a lack of empathy for communities of color and black communities in particular. When we think about the welfare queen, crack babies, et cetera, bringing that to today, I mean, the media writ large is also in the hands of everyday Americans. And what I mean by that is we have cell phones, we have Facebook Live. We have now taken things that used to be considered either over or not even happening and put them at the forefront of our vision. And when we see videos of black Americans just in the past couple of years, Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Sandra Bland, the list goes, Alton Sterling, Philando Castile, when we see videos of black Americans being killed by police, does that increase our empathy for black communities since we're no longer able to look away?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that question. I think this is something that I and many other folks have wrestled with over the course of the past several years, in which the emergence of these videos has become has saturated our media landscape more and more. It's hard to say. I think there's certainly something to be said for providing evidence and a sort of continuous stream of evidence that black people have not been lying for the past three centuries about the conditions that we've experienced, about our relationship to law enforcement, about how law enforcement treats us as compared to other communities. I think there for a long time, people simply didn't believe it. I do worry about what the constant inundation of videos of black people being harmed and black people being killed and black people being beaten. At what point is it increasing empathy? And at what point is it desensitizing us to the pain and suffering that black people are experiencing? And I don't know the answer to that question, but I know that this is something that scholars have been increasingly thinking about. But I think that is the tension, a recognition that these videos and everything around them have certainly contributed to a different type of dialogue, a different level of dialogue about racism in this country, but also at what cost? How is that impacting the health of so many people in a sort of long-term way? And is it, how do you find the balance between illuminating harsh realities and also not desensitizing ourselves to the violence that this world continues to enact on us?
We want to tie everything together, and I know that's really hard to do, but I'm wondering if you could tell us briefly, what will it take for us as a nation to have more empathy for each other?
I think those of us who, like yourself and like me, who think about these things all the time, can take for granted how many people don't know this information that feels very basic to many of us, but that is so central to the American story. And I do think, you know, it is not in our control. I have no way of knowing if when somebody reads about the myriad of different ways that public policy has decimated black communities, that next time they drive past a community that is destitute and a community that is populated largely by black people, will that shift their relationship to that community? Will that shift the way that they make a set of decisions about their own lives and how that impacts other people? I don't know. I think for some people it will be a transformative thing that shifts their personal and political lives. And I think for others, they might learn it and then it might stay there. But I do know that we have to begin by this sort of this process of national reckoning, national education, in order to move to the next step. We have to continue pushing to ensure that the conversation does not simply stay at the, oh, wow, I didn't know this, that's so sad, but then moves from that space into a, okay, what are we going to do about it now?
Clint Smith is a scholar and the author of Counting Dissent and the forthcoming nonfiction book, How the Word is Passed. Clint, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
And we wanted to leave you with the words of one of Clint Smith's poems featured in the 1619 Project from the New York Times.
Over the course of 350 years, 36,000 slave ships crossed the Atlantic Ocean. I walk over to the globe and move my finger back and forth between the fragile continents. I try to keep count of how many times I drag my finger across the bristled hemispheres, but grow weary of chasing a history that swallowed me. For every 100 people who were captured and enslaved, 40 died before they ever reached the New World. I pull my index finger from Angola to Brazil and feel the bodies jumping from the ship. I drag my thumb from Ghana to Jamaica and feel the weight of dysentery make an anvil of my touch. I slide my ring finger from Senegal to South Carolina and feel the ocean separate a million families. The soft hum of history spins on its tilted axis. A cavalcade of ghost ships wash their hands of all they carry.
Thanks for listening to our special Takeaway podcast. We appreciate your time, and please share this with your friends and people who'd be interested. Thanks to Polly Yurungu, Alexandra Boti, Ethan Oberman, Isabel Angel, and Deidre Depke for their production work on this. Vince Fairchild is our engineer, and Jay Cowett is our director and sound designer. This is The Takeaway.